Hey everyone, on today's show, we break down the Giants' win over the San Francisco 49ers on Monday Night Football, including how the pass protection improved and how that helped Eli Manning, and how the Giants can adjust some of their coverage issues on the defensive side of the ball. And for more on this game, please go to bigblueview.com, check out all the content we have there. So let's get to the show. Hello, and welcome to the Big Blue Review. I am Dan Pizzuta, joined by Chris Vlum, and we are here to talk about a Giants win? Is that right?
Yeah, they managed to get a win. They tried not to, but I guess one of the teams had to win eventually.
The Giants had a 27-23 win over the San Francisco 49ers on Monday Night Football. It came down to the Giants' final drive, which was a game-winning drive by the Giants and Eli Manning. It was a weird drive. It was not a normal march down the field, getting chunks of yards at a time and punching it into the end zone. It was a strange final drive.
It was more of a drunken stumble down the field.
Gonna read out what happened on this drive. So it starts with a touchback, incomplete to Beckham, 31 yards to Ingram, which was a really nice play. Ingram had a little hesitation and then slipped out to the outside, had a free sideline. 6 yards to Ingram, a pass negative 3 yards to Barkley. Awesome. So we're still doing that. That's cool. 2 minute warning. Then there was a false start on Will Hernandez. Then there was a defensive holding on Malcolm Smith on Barkley. That ended up being a automatic first down, which was going to be on a 3rd and 12. That was a pass that was, again, going to be to Barkley well behind the line of scrimmage. So the Giants got a bit of a gift there because they would not have picked up that first down if the pass was completed. And there wasn't a penalty. So then we go to the next first down. Then there's a holding penalty on Jamon Brown. So that sets up a 1st and 20. Then there's an incomplete. Then we got a 2nd and 20. There is defensive pass interference on a pass to Beckham. So that sets up a 1st down. Then another incompletion to Evan Ingram. Then a nice little angle route to Saquon Barkley. The 49ers had... It looked like they were trying to double cover Barkley, but both defenders were on the outside. So when Barkley cut in, he had free room to run down the middle of the field. And that was 23 yards. Then another pass to Ingram for 9 yards. And then the quick pass to Sterling Shepard for a 3-yard touchdown. A lot of penalties, a lot of weird plays. But overall, it ended up with the Giants going ahead and setting up what was eventually a game-winning drive.
Yeah, like I said, a drunken stumble of a drive, but it worked out. And they actually used some things that we have been... The table is broken from us banging it so hard. You know, like with the angle route to Barkley or actually getting Ingram down the field, he is so good at those kind of stick nod double moves where the defender almost expects him to run like a hook route or a curl route or something like that, and then he turns it upfield and just uses that speed. And so nice to see. He should use it more, or rather it should be called for him more. And again, with Barkley, get him past the line of scrimmage, get him some open field, and let him do what he does. Good things happen.
Yeah, so for Ingram, he had 5 targets for the game. 4 of them were on that last drive. Now, I joked on Twitter, it's been just been a season-long con to not use Evan Ingram, so there's no tape of him when you need to throw to him downfield in a game-winning situation, which was a joke, but kind of also the truth, because there really is no tape this year of Evan Ingram running down the field, which they did. And then, yeah, Barkley. They started the drive throwing to him behind the line of scrimmage. They tried to run a short pass to him on that 3rd down that there was the holding, where he would not have gotten the 1st down if there wasn't. But the big play, 23 yards, came on a nice ankle route. So he had 23 yards there. He only had 33 yards receiving in the game. So they did not use him a lot. Tried to use him on a wheel route earlier in the game. They actually ran a wheel route. But either it was supposed to be a back shoulder pass and Barkley didn't know that, or it was a terribly thrown ball by Eli because something did not look right there either way.
Yeah. Or it could be they're just so not used to throwing that route. Eli wasn't quite sure where to put it. Just judging by how Eli threw the ball, he looked confident about where he was placing it. And he dropped it about where you would expect a back shoulder pass to land, right by the sideline where Barkley's back shoulder would have been. So I'm wondering if there wasn't a miscommunication there.
One thing for Eli, he always looks confident when he's about to make a throw. The results of that throw vary wildly, but I think there's always a look of confidence before the throw.
Say it didn't look like an underthrow. It didn't look like he was trying to get it out in front of him and just didn't have the oomph for it. You know, it didn't look like the deep pass to Odell, where you could tell he put everything he had on it, and 55 yards was about all he had.
Yeah, there was that one deep pass to Beckham. He was wide open, and you could just see Beckham did a real good job spotting the ball, realized he was not going to be able to continue running, and he had to try to stop for it. And by the time the ball got there, there were two guys who were able to break it up. So yeah, that was definitely a problem that ended up not being a problem that flipped the game, because Beckham was able to score twice, and then they had that game-winning drive to get them there. So let's talk about the offense a little bit. I think one of the takeaways a lot of people had was that the offensive line just blocked better. That was partly the case, especially early in the game. So per Next Gen Stats, Eli Manning had an average of 2.6 seconds to throw, which, you know, is his actual league average. So they weren't getting the ball out quicker, but the pockets were there. San Francisco just didn't have much of an actual pass rush. They just weren't getting to Eli until later in the game. They did a little bit where they finally did have a sack. But San Francisco's pass rush has just not been something that's been there a lot this season. And I think we saw that. I think that made the job of the offensive line a little easier while they were going. I mean, San Francisco was 17th in defensive pressure rate coming into this game per Football Outsiders. A lot of their talent comes from the interior. I mean, DeForest Buckner has been really good this season, but on the edge, they don't really have that. I think one thing is, I guess we can focus on maybe Jamon Brown, who was the new addition there on the inside. I think he was really good early. He fell off
a bit towards the end of the game.
Yeah, he picked up a stunt early in the game on the first touchdown to Odell Beckham. It was a late stunt, and he picked it up real well. That was a rusher coming into Eli, but he adjusted and got it and gave him time to throw. I'm not sure if any of the guards earlier in the season would have been able to pick up the stunt when they did.
Nope, they wouldn't have.
And so that probably would have been a quarterback hit or a sack. So that was nice. But yeah, later in the game, Brown started to fall off a little bit. There was the holding penalty on the last drive. He blew a block that gave up a sack in the second half. And that was the only sack San Francisco had. But that was a blown block from Brown. So he was hit and miss. But on the offensive line this year, the hit and miss is probably a result you're going to take.
Yeah, the fact that there were hits, that he had successful plays, that picking up that stunt that allowed the touchdown probably earned him a second contract here. So that was good to see. I think the fact that Eli had relatively reliable blocking up front in the middle, particularly from the guard positions, definitely helped him. He's always been more confident, more capable when he has a pocket he can step up into. And there were plays where he actually stepped up and evaded pressure that was coming off of the edges, particularly from Chad Wheeler's side. And that was good to see.
Yeah, there was a comfort. So while the time to throw wasn't much different than he's had, the situations in which he had that time to throw, I think were different. There wasn't going to be someone in his face constantly as he was getting the ball off. And that, I think, played a part. And I think that's part of what made him look better. Now, with this win and the game-winning drive, I think we have some type of narrative that Eli Manning is back. I think he was fine in this game overall. He had the three touchdowns, which definitely help. One of them came from the 10, one came from the three. So, you know, it's not like they were getting big chunks of yards in the passing game. I mean, he averaged 6.1 yards per attempt. Obviously, the three touchdowns help. He had an 85.3 QBR, which means a quarterback basically who played like Eli, you'd expect to win 85.3% of the time. I think the play calling and how the game played out in the first and second halves were completely changed, because he like started the game 6 of 9 for 26 yards, which was 2.9 yards per attempt, but he had a touchdown, so he had a quarterback rating of 107.2. So please don't tell me that quarterback rating is a relevant stat when you can throw for 2.9 yards per attempt and still have a quarterback rating of 107. But that's what it was early. But late, I think they threw the ball downfield a little more. Eli ended up with an average depth of target of 8.5 per next-gen stats, which is fine. That's about average-ish of where we're looking at where most quarterbacks have been. It's better than like the six or so he usually has when definitely the offense isn't going right. So there were definitely some more downfield throws, which is good. They didn't all connect, but I think just getting the ball out there definitely helped.
Yeah, that's what this offense is built to do. When you've got three of your top four receiving targets have legitimate 4.4 speed, you gotta get them down the field. And the change in game plan at halftime, which maybe the 49ers going on a seven and a half minute drive that just chewed up clock and wound up putting them up two scores, played a role in it. But the change in game plan from the first half to the second half was dramatic. The fact that Eli finished with an average depth of target of 8.5 yards and was only going about 2.5 in the first half is honestly impressive. Just showed how much further down the field he was throwing the ball on his average pass in the second half.
Yeah, it really looked like two completely different game plans. And the passing improving in the second half is definitely what helped the offense. I mean, look like it did. I still don't think the offense looked particularly good, but I think we can agree it was the passing that got them there, and it was not the running game. I think we're going to... Okay, so we're going to have some narrative that comes out here. Someone is that the Giants are now 1-0 when Saquon Barkley carries the ball 20 times or more. So he got 20 carries, only 67 yards. By expected points added, -3.82 expected points added on those carries. He had 6 successful carries in the first half. He finished the game with 6 successful carries. So that's just a 30% success rate, which is not good.
Or a 0% success rate in the second half.
Yeah. 0% success rate in the second half on his carries. It's not good. The Giants love running the ball on 2nd and 10 after incompletions. And all that does is sets up 3rd and long. And that's kind of what a lot of carries did in the second half. So please, please don't make this argument. Please don't listen to anyone who made the argument that the balance between run pass what helped the Giants, because it was not. Barkley's running was not good in this game.
No, I don't know how you can call a run game successful when it relies on the running back stringing together jump cuts and making 2, 3, 4 defenders miss in the backfield, and then carrying a fifth for another extra 3 yards if he happens to get past the line of scrimmage. That's not a successful run. That's a hell of a lot of work by the running back, and it's not sustainable, which is something we have seen time and time and time and time and time again this year. The Giants can't run block just at all. And any success they have is basically Saquon Barkley putting on his cape, but you can't expect him to do that 20 times when your passing game is actually working. In fact, you can't expect him to do that 20 times at all. You know, it's not sustainable.
No, you can try to give him the ball 20 times and hope maybe one or two of them are something that breaks, and that's
which been, is their run scheme.
Right, and that has been what the Giants have done so far this season. But then you get the low success rates that Barkley has, and then you have the games like this where there was the 18-yard run, but that was it. And San Francisco was able to hold Barkley for the rest of the game. So take out that 18-yard run, and then Barkley had 19 other carries for 49 yards. That's not part of a successful offense. That's not how you run. So you can say, yeah, they kept with the running game, and that's why the offense was bad. But I think if you say that, you're wrong. I'm just gonna put it like that. If you think that because Barkley got 20 carries and because there was some commitment to the run game, that really had no impact on how the offense went.
So what you're saying is they establishing the run didn't set them up for success on the deep passes later on.
No, it did not. No.
Eventually we will kill that narrative.
Yeah. Yeah, what happened on the deep passes later on is San Francisco is not very good in pass coverage when it comes to not being Richard Sherman.
Yeah, and Richard Sherman is exactly the wrong kind of cornerback you want covering Odell Beckham.
Yeah, that wasn't bad. I think the Giants did a pretty good job of keeping Beckham away from Sherman on plays that mattered. Because Sherman is still a guy who's going to play one side of the field. Yes. He played to the right side of the offense, and the Giants were able to move Beckham around. All his big plays came on the left, and that was good. I think one thing I didn't like, and if we go back to that game-winning drive, the first play was a pass to Beckham, who was lined up on the right against Sherman. So that seemed weird to me to start that drive trying to target Richard Sherman when the alternative is to not do that. And it's very easy to not do that. You just line Beckham up on the other side of the formation. Yeah. And eventually, of course, it didn't really matter because they somehow got down the field. But yeah, I think the Giants did a pretty good job of avoiding Sherman. They did a lot to the left side. And Eli threw 8 passes to the right side of the field, completed 4 for 66 yards, but all 3 touchdowns came to the left side. So Eli was 4 for 4 between 10 and 20 yards on the left side for 71 yards. So when the Giants were having success, it was going to the left and going away from Sherman. So I think that was a good part of the plan, and at least plays that mattered went to that left side.
Yeah, definitely. That's the downside of having a corner who is really good but only plays sides. It's too easy to avoid them. You need 2 good corners if you're going to do that.
Right, yeah, and that's something San Francisco doesn't really have at the moment. So if we want to talk about exploiting pieces of a defense, we have to talk about what San Francisco did, which is something smart teams should do. So the first half game plan, apparently, for the 49ers was if they saw Landon Collins one-on-one against George Kittle was throw to George Kittle, which throwing to George Kittle is a good move regardless. When he's definitely one-on-one coverage with Landon Collins, that's definitely something an offense should want to exploit. And then when San Francisco shifted to the second half, the game plan was whoever Alec Ogletree is covering, throw to him. And that was something that worked out pretty well for San Francisco.
Yeah. Kittle is a good tight end. He's going to give a lot of players difficulties in coverage. But also, Landon Collins is not great in man coverage, especially against more athletic players. And Kittle is an athletic tight end. He's maybe not quite as athletic as Evan Ingram, but he's also not far behind him either.
I'm actually not sure if that's true. So if you go back to that draft class, which was like a historically athletic draft class per Spark, which kind of is a composite testing score that takes all the combined results and kind of puts them together, Kittle was the most athletic of that group. That included Ingram, that included O.J. Howard. That was historically athletic group, and Kittle actually was the number one tight end in Spark. So he was just as athletic as the guys who got drafted way ahead of him in that class. He only went in the fifth round, which was kind of crazy.
Well, I would say, or he did rate higher with the Spark. Ingram, I believe, ranked slightly higher in just raw athleticism, just straight numbers. But he also weighs a little bit less than Kittle does. There's a difference of about 9 pounds between them. So, like, you know, 40-yard dash, Ingram timed about a tenth of a second faster. He jumped about an inch higher. Kittle had a 4.77 short shuttle to Ingram's 4.23, and he had a 7-second three cone at Iowa's Pro Day, which is, Pro Day time should always be a little bit suspect, but at the combine, Ingram had 6.92. So just in terms of raw, absolute ability to move, Ingram is able to do it a little bit better, but Kittle is almost as good, and he's a little bit bigger. So they're both really good athletes, and it's both a bad matchup for Landon Collins, who's pretty fast in a straight line, but that's about it.
Yeah, so early in the broadcast, and I'd want to talk about the commentary as little as possible, but the Monday Night Booth is just, it's terrible. Early in the game, they said that the Giants were trying to get a Collins on Kittle matchup, and that's something they liked. If that's true, that's terrible game planning by the Giants.
It is.
Landon Collins is not a guy you really want one-on-one against really anyone. But especially a tight end like Kittle. And the Kittle is elite after the catch, too.
Oh, definitely.
Per next-gen stats, he was third among all receivers in yards after the catch above expectation. And Marquise Goodwin was number two. Albert Wilson of Miami, who's out for the year, was number one. So if you're talking active players right now, it was Goodwin and Kittle. So those guys get helped out by the scheme where they get openings, and then they are crazy good after the catch. So lining Collins up against Kittle, if that was something the Giants purposely did in the first half and they liked that matchup, they need to go back to the drawing board there. And whatever information they looked at that made them think that would be a good matchup, they need to really reassess whatever that was so it does not happen again.
Yes. I don't think it would have taken much film study to see that Kittle was basically Mullins' number one receiver, even though he's a tight end. Why not double cover him? Basically constrict him the way other teams try to constrict Odell Beckham. Even though the rest of the Giants secondary isn't particularly good, you should be able to at least try to make San Francisco beat you with somebody other than Kittle. Right, that's really just basic film study and game planning.
Yeah, and I mean, it's Yeah, there should have been a little more to get onto Kittle. So he leads San Francisco with 71 targets. The next most targeted player is Pierre Garçon, who's at 45. And he's only played and started 8 games. He hasn't even been like that big a part of the passing game. And then it goes down to Kendrick Bourne at 38. So when, no matter who the quarterback is for San Francisco, Kittle is the guy they throw at. And that's just been the case all year. But then later in the game, Matt Breida became the go-to guy, and that was making sure he got on Alec Ogletree. And Ogletree just could not cover in this game. I don't think that's a surprise to us. We've talked about Alec Ogletree's liability in coverage before. This kind of, I guess, finally happened on a national stage, so I guess more people were paying attention. More people now realize he struggles in coverage, but San Francisco definitely game planned to get one-on-one coverage with running backs and tight ends against Ogletree, and it really paid off.
Yeah, Ogletree has not been the player people thought he might have been as, you know, an athletic linebacker, you know, all that. If the Giants thought they were getting their money backer who could, you know, take away the middle of the field and cover tight ends and running backs, they did not get it in that trade. And honestly, it's definitely too bad that he is as bad in coverage as he is, because it forces the team to take BJ Goodson off of the field and put a nickel linebacker in. Yeah, before Ray Armstrong was injured and then released, I had kind of been thinking to myself quietly that I like the combination of Armstrong and Goodson better than Ogletree and anyone else.
What really is bad about the position Ogletree puts the Giants in when he struggles as poorly as he did on Monday night, there aren't many other options there. You can put Goodson in, which the Giants should probably do more of, but then you have, you know, Tay Davis, who is an undrafted rookie who's going to play. You probably don't want to put, I mean, Lorenzo Carter was more of a straight up linebacker who rushed the passer sometimes at Georgia, but he's working on being an edge rusher. I don't think you want to take those edge rush snaps away from Carter. So there's not really another option on the roster right now. So Ogletree, as much as he struggled against San Francisco, still one of 5 players who played all 73 defensive snaps. The Giants can't even take him off the field, and he's the guy with the headset, so he's the defensive play caller too when he's out there. And it's just that has not been good for the Giants, and he's struggled a bunch in coverage all season. I'm actually surprised this is the first time an opposing offense really made an effort to go at him. This was really the first time he was targeted on multiple plays. I'm surprised that's the first time that's happened, because I would think offenses would want to try to go at him more often, just because he does struggle one-on-one, and that's been something that went back to the Rams. That was something we did know, that most of us who did watch him with the Rams did know that was a problem for him.
Yeah, lack of coverage is a big reason why he's no longer on the Rams. You can't be paying a player as much as you pay Ogletree if you have to try to hide him.
Yeah, but there is no hiding him. He's the middle linebacker who plays every snap. You can't hide him. If defenses now are going to notice that more and take advantage of that more, that's really going to be a problem, because there's just no way around it.
Maybe it's a bad sign for other defenses if they don't notice that, or sorry, other offenses, if they don't notice that and they don't go after him.
Yeah, so maybe you can play BJ Goodson a little more. That wouldn't be bad. He had a good game, and I think Now, regardless of the two interceptions, I think the two interceptions he had, he was in the right place at the right time. He personally didn't do much on those interceptions. He had both balls just kind of bounce into his hands. But I think overall, he played pretty well outside of those two picks. I would definitely like to see him get a little more time on the field.
Yeah, and he had a good game against Washington before the bye week with Ogletree out. Yeah, he was on the field for almost every snap, and he didn't really have any breakdowns. He's not the rangiest guy in coverage, but I think part of the reason why he did have those two interceptions and being in the right place at the right time is he does have a good awareness of where the play is going to go, so he can get himself to be in the right place.
Yeah, he has much, much better instincts. And I think something people bring up about Ogletree is that he is really athletic. And that's true, but he's a step slow to react to these things, so that athleticism goes out the window. If he's already a step slow, he's not athletic enough to recover. And that is part of the problem. But we have someone like Goodson, who I think reacts a little better. He can make up for not having that athleticism because he's a step ahead. So that's something I'd maybe like to see more of going into the second half of the season. Goodson only played 47% of the snaps against San Francisco. And that's part of the Giants aren't running out a lot of linebacker heavy sets. They're spread out a little more, and they went into a big nickel a little more where they had three safeties on the field. They had a bunch of plays where they played Landon Collins, Curtis Riley, and they had Michael Thomas out on the field, who played 53% of the snaps. That's definitely his highest of the season.
Thomas played as much as any two or three games put together, and I won't say he jumped off the field, but he was at least involved in the defense.
He had one pass defended, but it looked like they wanted to play a little more three safety looks, which with how the linebackers have played this year, I'm not totally against. Opposed to that. It looked like in the second half, they kind of moved Collins to more of a linebacker type look. They tried to get him out of one-on-one coverage, which is good. And that might be the way to go. Especially at safety, when you have Curtis Riley back there often as the single high safety, and we know
which is less than ideal,
that has not worked out well. So maybe putting another safety back there while letting Collins still play closer to the line, that could work out. Maybe we'll see that with some more Michael Thomas. Maybe Sean Chandler will play that role a little bit more. Maybe, I don't know, maybe you see Grant Haley play there a little more. Haley played more slot corner. He had a real nice tackle for loss on a swing pass. He played 42% of the snaps. He had a pass defended too. So I'd definitely like to see him again play a little more. So the coverage outside of the linebackers held up pretty well, I think, and San Francisco doesn't have the strongest wide receivers who are playing. But I think part of what allowed those linebackers to get exploited in coverage is there really was no pass rush here. San Francisco was kind of able to do what they wanted. Nick Mullins just kind of hung out for the most part. Giants only got three quarterback hits, and most of them came on blitzes. One was from Alec Ogletree on a blitz. One was Lorenzo Carter, one was Olivier Vernon. There was just not a consistent pass rush to rush whatever Mullins was going to be doing.
That's another argument to give Lorenzo Carter more snaps and definitely more pass rush snaps. I mean, I am not going to be angry that he got that roughing the passer penalty for delivering a good tackle to Mullins a split second after he released the ball.
Yeah, I think part of it is probably how the tackle happened. He kind of got his arm, Mullins had his arm up, Carter kind of got his arm around his neck a little bit, and he kind of almost like rock bottomed him to the ground. So I think how the hit happened was probably worse. But yeah, if he's getting to the quarterback, I don't think you you have an issue with that. And he's someone who has flashed, but the flashes haven't happened quite as much as you would maybe like. He's someone who's still learning the edge position. In the rookie report I did over the bye week, just assessing the plays of the rookies, he was still someone I said I'd like to wait and see, because he still needs things that need to develop. There are some people who are very optimistic about him, and if he does develop into learning to use his hands and not getting blocked out of plays as often as he does, can be a good pass rusher. But I think this is the first time, I think, since Olivier Vernon has been back that he was not the Giants' best pass rusher, and I think that was Carter.
Oh, definitely. I am optimistic about Carter, but that is kind of contingent on him continuing to develop and really learn how to put those physical tools of his to use. Yeah, he's got that real quick first step. He's got that ridiculous length of his, the agility that actually lets him drop into coverage and be competent. Yeah, he just needs to figure it out and just keep developing. Now, whether or not that happens is another matter entirely.
Right, and I think that's something, at this point, you have to keep him on the field and see what he does. I think that's really the only way he's going to learn. So he was probably the one bright spot on this defense. He flashed a little more against San Francisco than I think he has in other games, even though he's maybe been more productive. He had 3 tackles for loss in this game, which, I mean, anytime you have a defensive player in the backfield that often, that's pretty good, even if the pass rush and there were no sacks. But getting in the backfield at that rate is good.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, even if his snaps have to come at the expense of Kareem Martin and Josh Morrow, fine, so be it. Now, he and Goodson are probably the Giants' 2 best linebackers right now, and they need to figure out some way to keep both of them on the field.
Yeah, and those lineup changes are maybe something we'll see going on in the second half. I don't think it's going to be doing anyone any good to keep Alec Ogletree on the field for 100% of the snaps for the rest of the season. So maybe rotating him out a little more, it will give Goodson some more time. It can maybe get Carter in there a little more often too. I think that's probably the best way to go about it, because I think right now you want to try to develop these younger guys instead of sticking with the veterans who just aren't playing well. I think that's definitely what this second half of the season has to be about.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you don't rebuild by sticking with guys who you know what they are, and what they are is mediocre at best. Part of rebuilding is finding the young guys on your team who can develop and be answers, be viable pieces down the road.
Right. Yeah, that's all we can have for this second half of the season. Even with the win here, the Giants are a very well out of the playoff picture. But, you know, a win is nice, and it's good to see some development and some improvement on places on the field. I'm not totally sure how many teams the Giants would have beaten with that exact play that they had. I think luckily it was against San Francisco. And so we'll see. They have a game against Tampa Bay, who has not been great.
Especially on the defensive side of the ball.
Especially on the defensive side of the ball, yeah. If the Giants aren't moving the ball there, I think that's another place we can say they'd have an issue. So hopefully they would be able to move the ball against Tampa Bay there. So I think we can end it there. You can subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And again, remember, subscribing to this feed gets you the review show. It gets you 2 Valentine's Views shows per week. And it gets you our new college football and NFL draft show we'll have at the end of the week. Thank you to everyone who listened to that show. That was actually a fairly popular show. So I'm glad you guys enjoyed that. And we're looking forward to getting more episodes episodes of that up. Please rate and review this podcast if you have not. We will be back at the end of the week for that draft show. Ed will be here on this feed with a Valentine's view shortly. So thank you guys for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Hi, I'm Karis Fisher. I want to tell you about another podcast you should check out. It's called Recode Decode. Every week, I talk to tech and media's key players about how they're changing our world. I interview tech executives like Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, political figures like Hillary Clinton, and media personalities like John Carreyrou, who literally wrote the book on Theranos. Once again, the name of the show is Recode Decode, hosted by me, Karis Fisher. You can find it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. See you there.
Support for this show comes from Fundrise. Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/fox. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.